Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I can't believe mine. All
of this belongs to you. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to devote most of our program to a series of commentaries to try to begin the year by challenging most of the alternative and mainstream media's imbalances, inaccuracies, out-and-out deceptions about important issues. We're going to, for example, share with you today information you have not read, heard, or seen anywhere else in any other media about the truth about Syria. And everything that we were told, I mean everything, officially and through all the media, were simply lies. But we're going to be citing government documents, WikiLeaks statements, proving every single point. Now, if I can find this information and present it, so too could others that have enormous resources and staffs at their availability. But they haven't. Why? Laziness, indifference, or because some, certainly, are influenced by staying in good favor with official Washington. So we're going to play some of these for you. We're also going to show you that in our personal perspective, the White Helmets should not only not receive the Nobel Prize or any other award, but they are completely aligned at the hip with the terrorist organizations. And so therefore, everything that you've heard, including on other stations, they have not done their homework. Sloppy, inaccurate, indifferent, possibly. But we're going to give you the truth on the White Helmets today as well. Also, we're going to give you proof absolute that the CIA has control over most of the media in this country. And who's going to tell us that? A former director of the CIA. And so you'll hear from him about how much control they have. I dare say there's not a single news source in the United States, major news source, that they haven't compromised completely. But also, why do people back away from the idea that non-commercial entities could also have provocateurs and agents on the payroll of the CIA and other intelligence agencies? He certainly could. Also today, some comments from Edward Curtin from Global Research about the plague. I will also be sharing about how the FDA manipulates the media, and therefore, when you're told that a new drug is safe and effective, what's the proof? But when you can find out that their medical marijuana, the cannabinoids, the oil, has incredible benefit for stopping seizures, brain cancers, lung cancers, epilepsy, they deny it. How is it possible with 15,000 articles in their literature, Library of Medicine, which is the library that all governmental agencies use, it's official, it's been sanctioned by the government and by the National Academy of Sciences. If you have 15,000 articles on the cannabinoids, and yet you still say that there is no proof that it works and you're putting people in prison for using it, well, then it's not science or medicinal value that's lacking. It's political will to fire everyone working at the FDA, the CDC. In fact, I would fire everyone in every one of the U.S. public health agencies, every single person right down the line. I'd give a day of truth and reconciliation. Tell the truth about what you know, where you've seen crimes against humanity or crimes against the citizens of the United States. You can keep your job. If not, you lose it. And then suddenly you would see a whole lot of people coming forward. And you say, well, if you knew that this was hurting people, why didn't you say something? And then that brings in an entirely different aspect. how selfish people can be about keeping their jobs in spite of the fact they know something can be hurting people. By the way, I'll just give you one example of that. For decades, the tobacco industry never had to settle a lawsuit. They won every single one. They never lost one. Because there was no hard science showing that a individual smoking cigarettes developed cancer from those cigarettes. And they had the best scientists that money could buy on their side. And so they won. And one particular meeting where they had all seven of the top tobacco industry people on board, they testified under oath that they knew nothing about any addictive qualities of tobacco. A whistleblower came forward and showed that they had been lying. Now, here's what was brought out. Both the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, knew that tobacco would cause lung cancer and emphysema and heart disease, and that it was addictive. They had that information in their files, but because it was considered proprietary, meaning belonging to the exclusive use and profit and benefit of the company, they were restrained from making it public. So I went back and I looked at how many millions of Americans, and you're over 10 million Americans died from cigarette smoking. So on the one hand, we kept something secret that had we known early on and banned cigarettes, you would have been able to save 10 million people. So you weigh it, 10 million human lives in America, that's just in America, versus a couple people who could have been fired or sued for telling us the truth. So that's what I'm referring to. Washington is replete with people who know the truth and refuse to tell it. Then why should they deserve our support and salaries? Anyhow, we're going to deal with that today. And we always start with the latest on health and healing. First off, University of East Finland has a study on vitamin D and what happens when you don't have enough. And in northern latitudes, a lot of people don't get out into the sun for about 45 minutes a day over at least one-third of their body, so the body can, in the skin, can manufacture vitamin D3. And this was published in Scientific Report. It says that if you don't get enough vitamin D, you could have chronic headaches. And a lot of people have chronic headaches. Now, you can have other causes of the headaches, but a lack of vitamin D we never knew. Now we add that in. Childhood poverty can rob adults of psychological health, according to Cornell University. A large and growing body of research shows that poor kids, and by the way, that's now half of all the children in the United States, 50%, grow up to have a host of physical problems as adults. Now add poor psychological health to the list. This is according to what Cornell researchers are saying. So there's a sweeping new study conducted by following participants over a 15-year period. It's the first to show that childhood poverty can cause significant psychological damage in adulthood. Impoverished children in the study had more antisocial conduct, such as aggression and bullying, an increased feeling of helplessness than kids from middle-income backgrounds, the study said. And poor kids also have more chronic physiological stress and more deficits in short-term spatial memory. Quote, what this means is, if you're born poor, you're on a trajectory to have more of these kinds of psychological problems. And so why? Why? The answer is relatively straightforward. Stress. Quote, with poverty, you're exposed to lots of stress. Everybody has stress, but low-income families, low-income children, have a lot more of it. And the parents are also under a lot of stress. So for kids, there's a cumulative risk exposure. So, quote, people walk around with this idea in their head that if you work hard, play by the rules, you can get ahead. But you can't. And that's the reality. Now, just the other day, it was shown how many people are shot were killed in Chicago. And Chicago's quickly getting up there to where it would compete with one of the Mexican cities for the number of people shot in a given year. Mexico leads that. Honduras is even more. But at no point did I hear anyone talking outside of the police are depressed or they're not going after the gang members. And so what we need is more police or bring in some National Guard where you, by law you can't. It's a local and state issue. And so that's where they kept the argument. And I'm thinking, someone on this panel, someone say, what causes the gangs? Why would someone belong to a gang? What causes the violence? What is it like to live in those projects? And of course, no one lives in those projects who's in the major media. None of the reporters do, and none of the politicians do. So as a result, they have a very superficial understanding. It's always, you know, we got the big hammer. Do we need a bigger hammer, a gigantic hammer? And instead of saying, what would happen if we took the $1.5 trillion that Bernie Sanders and his buddies are spending on this worthless airplane? That's just one plane, by the way, the development of this one plane. Or that Obama has put over what will amount to $1.5 trillion on a new set of nuclear weapons, even though we have enough nuclear weapons now to kill every person on the planet 27 times over. And put that into, what do people need? Well, they would like a good education, quality education, where a child could go to any school in America, no matter how poor the neighborhood was, and know that the curriculum, the teachers, the environment doesn't look like a prison. Rather, they can learn, where they can walk home without feeling someone's going to beat them up for their money or their bike, where you can sit out on your porch without fearing being shot by a drive-by or gang turf conflict. You have to rebuild neighborhoods. You have to bring jobs back into those neighborhoods. And with those jobs and a living wage, then you have a structure. It reminds me of a city, St. Louis, in an area of the city where they built housing projects. But these were really wonderful projects. They had playgrounds, swimming pools, they had all the facilities you'd want. But then the city itself started to see the migration of people to the suburbs. As they migrated to the suburbs, they no longer paid taxes to St. Louis proper. They paid it to the local municipalities. And so there was the flight to the suburbs. And a lot of this was white flight. As a result, there wasn't enough money there to maintain these facilities. So over a period of time, when windows were broken, they weren't fixed. When there was proper plumbing, there wasn't a problem. Now there was improper plumbing, broken plumbing. Then they would run out of fuel because the city didn't have enough money to pay for the oil. And so in the wintertime, people really had it rough. And then there was no security. So then that was a magnet for people who were the criminal element, who were a tiny minority of the population that came in and exploit them. Then the gangs came in, and then the gangs would take over these complexes. So to go in or out of the complex, you know, you had to pay some form of tribute to the gangs. And over a period of 10 years, what had been a model became a ghetto until finally it was so bad, they just tore the whole thing down. I say that that is not unique to any class, race, ethnicity, or social strata. If you were to take the billionaire's building on Park Avenue where the Koch brothers live and the hedge fund billionaires, and you were to provide it with no services, you had no security at the front desk, so anybody could walk in and out of the building. You didn't fix any broken locks on the front doors. You didn't pick up the trash so it might accumulate for 2 months outside, blocking the sidewalk and smelling. You wouldn't repair anything. You'd go a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks with no water or heat. You would suddenly have a ghetto building. And so what would you do? Tear down the building? So where you have wealth, you have power. Where you have power and wealth, you have control. And therefore, the circumstances of your existence are going to be controlled by the position of power and wealth within that control system. The problem is that 90% of Americans, approximately, could be 85%, do not have control over most of the circumstances in their lives. Now you have a whole new generation of computerized technology that's going to replace a lot of the skilled labor. Before, it was primarily lower-end economic strata. Now it's moving up. Then you have your visa people coming in. And then you have offshoring. So when you have mergers and acquisitions that are parasites, the lowest low are people who buy a company, load it with debt, take out huge amounts of profit, and then fire the employees, outsource the work to China, keep the brand, which is what they're really paying for in their market share, until it finally dissolves down into nothingness. And it closes like Linen Things and Circuit City and so many other corporations now, Macy's and Sears closing a lot of stores this week. Macy's, between Sears and Macy's, there are going to be about 10,000 unemployed Americans. But when they were run without being taken over, they were fine. Now when you take them over, the whole reason you take something over is so you can profit from it. And you have the capacity to create debt. So we have these economic parasites. In Wall Street, these are the biggest parasites in the history of the world. These people are functionally worthless. They're intellectually illiterate. They're culturally subordinated by greed. All they want to know is, here's a big check. Put me on the board of the Museum of Modern Art. Former classmate of mine was one of the curators. I know how it works there. You know, people don't know anything about art, but they've got the money to write the big checks, and therefore they get seats on these places. So what happens is, as a society, we don't step back and say, how do we ghettoize a whole country where we have the have and have-nots? Detroit's a good example. One of the most expensive places in America is in Grosse Pointe, but that's where the GE, General Motors executive lives, and the other car manufacturers live. But the rest of it's a ghetto. Because we allow infrastructure and the systems of supporting that infrastructure to be abandoned. And we can change that. One city at a time, one block at a time. But we have to have the will to do that. So let's say you grow up in that environment. So each day you go to school, you don't know if you're going to be beaten up. You don't know if your sister's going to be hassled by gangbangers. You don't know if the teacher's going to diagnose you with ADD or ADHD because the class is boring and you're not being shown how to think critically, just how to take a test. And you're dealing with this. You're going home to where your mom might not be able to have enough food for you that day. And then some guys come along and say, hey, I heard you're having a little trouble. I'm all right. Here, take this. See this? You can go to this store and buy all the groceries you want. So you and your family, your two sisters, and you never have to be hungry again. Well, I don't want this, man. I don't want this. No. You're wanting something. We're not wanting anything in return. We're helping you. How tempting is that? Then next month they come and say, hey, we paid your mom's rent for the next 6 months for you. So your mom doesn't have to work two jobs. Why would you do that? Well, because, hey, you're one of us. You know, we're on the low end of this whole social strata. Nobody cares about us. So we have to care about each other. You can bring someone along for 6 months to a year before they finally realize there is a consequence, there is a payback when you have to become a part of their gang and do something. We used to have very few gang members. Now we have over 1.5 million, and it'll probably double. 3 million people are members of gangs. Now the gangs have a lot of power in particular areas. So we're not even asking, what can we do to lessen the gang influence? What can we do to rebuild the inner cities? What can we do to give these people back jobs? How can we do that? How can we finance it? These are the conversations we should be having, in my opinion. So on top of that now, a young person ends up realizing that they have never been validated as a good human being by society. They're just a survivalist. And that creates an enormous amount of mental health challenges and stress. So now when they get out of being a young person, become a teenager or young adult, all of that epigenetic energy follows them. And that they pay a price for. So shouldn't we be paying attention to these issues? I believe we should. University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. Now, you've heard me mention many times that the best honey in the world is the New Zealand Manuka, M-A-N-U-K-A honey. It is good for everything. You got sores, infections, you put it on it. It's as good as any antibiotic for SARS because none of those work. And it's good for sore throats, colds, flu. We hear some good news. Most of the commercially available therapeutic honey is derived from New Zealand, produced from the Manuka plant, which exhibits broad-spectrum antimicrobial activity against a diverse range of bacteria and yeast pathogens. And Manuka honey is also equally effective against multi-drug-resistant bacteria. That's according to the latest study. And now the activity of Manuka honey is largely due to the presence of what is called MGO. This is a methyl glycoxal, which is produced non-enzymatically from DHA, which is present in Manuka nectar. And now they have found that they are having bees working, living in a given area of Australia that are able to do the same thing. So now we can add New Zealand along with New Zealand for producing Manuka honey. And whenever we get any studies on this, I'll share them with you to make sure that they have indeed done the exact same thing. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. And before we take our break, just one construct, and that is, how many times have you woken up and you just looked at your life and it seemed like you were living in some form of a prison where you were constrained or restricted by your beliefs, by your diet, by your friendships, by your family, by your conditioning, that the real you could not emerge, the authentic self could not emerge? Well, Edward Curtin has some musings on this, and I'm sure many of the people in this audience, certainly of my generation, grew up on Albert Camus. And it was on this, actually it was yesterday, in 1960, that he died in a car crash. And anyone who had been following his life at the time, you knew that he was writing about, he thought his true work hadn't even begun yet. He was only 46 years old. Now, at 46, he'd written, remember, The Stranger, The Fall, but most importantly, The Plague, and plus other works. He had won the Nobel Prize for Literature, yet he felt that in his writings, he had to hide behind a mask that stifled him. After all these successes, as well as criticisms from both the left and the right, French intelligentsia, he was looking forward to a time when he would be able to speak his own truth without the mask of depersonalization, to enter a period of creation. He was finding a new voice beyond the prison of a classical form he felt he needed to escape. In his briefcase, by the way, there was an uncompleted manuscript of that effort, the autobiographical and possibly one of the few partially written manuscripts that was end up published as a novel called The First Man. And he had a whole new lyrical style to it. Albert was a true artist. He tried to serve both beauty and suffering. Quintessentially a man of his era, he was haunted by the image of the world as a prison. That, of course, was exemplified by the novel, The Plague. And if you haven't read it, please read it. It's a tale of a town cut off from the world by a pestilence whose residents lack the imagination to foresee. Even as it happens, they remain oblivious. And when I think of that then, reading it, and I think of what it is today, to be explaining to people you're living in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you're not going to be able to be supported or sustained there, and they look at you with these glass and stares. And that's what he was saying. People who were living in an oblivion. Why? Because they lack the imagination to foresee. Even as it happens, they remain oblivious. And that's unfortunate. So they thought themselves wise because they worked hard. They were diligent. They obeyed the rules. And they were bored by their habits. They were heavily drugging themselves with alcohol and watching movies, anything to distract themselves. They failed to grasp the significance of the, what did he say, the squelching roundness of a still warm body, of the plague-bearing rats that emerged from their underworld to die in the streets. To them, the plague was unthinkable. It was simply an abstraction. Abscesses and something they could not imagine. So today, ask the average person, young, middle-aged, old, what exactly are you doing to understand the world you live in, to maintain happiness and health, to be conscious of the choices you make so that they do not bode ill to the world or to anyone or anything? What do you mean? Well, do you know where the meat on your table came from? No. Do you care? Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you care where your shirt was made, your dress was made? Do you care about the chemicals to use in your cleaning materials? Do you care about where the products that you make go and how they're used? Just becoming conscious again, waking up again, that every single thought, every single action has a consequence. Sooner or later. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
In all my conversation, you're my inspiration. In everything
I'd like to welcome all of you. Nice to have you with us. And keep in mind that 5 days a week, Monday to Friday at noon Eastern Time, if you want to call in and listen to this program from anywhere in Canada and in the United States, listening live by any portable device, I'll give you the number. 605-561-5119, 605-561-5119. But let's say you can't. You miss it. But you can download it on the archives. Let me give you the archive phone number you can call in. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And now I'm going to play you a clip concerning Syria, one that you have not heard, one that you're not aware of. There's little gaps in between for maybe 10 seconds, maybe three of these, because they're showing footage. But this is extremely relevant and important because it shows you, proves to you, that we've been lied to. Listen in, please.
Our reporter, Zaina Hodda, defied a media ban to enter Daraa and sent us this story.
This is a city draped in black and a city raging with anger. For the past week, Daraa has been burying their dead. Demonstrators killed while clashing with security forces. Dozens are believed to have died. People here say at least 150, far higher than the figure of 37 provided by the state.
The corporate media tells us the civil war in Syria began after Bashar al-Assad's troops killed Arab Spring protesters in Daraa and other cities. The truth, however, is something different. In fact, it's the exact opposite of what the official narrative would have us believe. The conflict that has so far cost more than 400,000 Syrian lives began in Daraa, a town near the border with Jordan. According to the media, the revolt began in March 2011 after teenagers were arrested for anti-Assad graffiti. Daraa citizens were outraged and poured into the streets to protest, and this was met with a violent response by the government. A Daraa journalist, quoted by CNN, said the protests were the flame of a revolution that would spread across the country. Syrians took inspiration from the so-called Arab Spring revolts in Egypt and Tunisia. According to Syrian journalist Stephen Sahouni, the uprising was staged by foreigners. Jihadi mercenaries supported by the United States and NATO in Libya were in Daraa well before the protests. In addition to Libyans, members of the Muslim Brotherhood worked out of the Omari Mosque in Daraa. The plan they prepared was engineered by the CIA just over the border in Jordan. Weapons were stockpiled at a mosque well before the demonstrations. Muslim Brotherhood provocateurs attacked Syrian security forces during the demonstrations in Daraa, Aleppo, Damascus, and other cities.
So there was violence right at the beginning.
Yes. And the Syrian security forces had orders from the Syrian president that to not use a gun. They had only sticks in their hand only. And tens of Syrian police, Syrian security forces, were knifed, stabbed, and beaten by either by knives or rocks or sticks. Uh-huh. And some of them have died, okay. Martyred.
At the very beginning, in Latakia, the crowds would come out on a Friday after the noon prayer. This was like the habit. And so they would come out and they'd start, you know, we want freedom, we want democracy, we want blah, blah, blah. Okay, then the police, of course, would be there around in anticipation. And at the beginning, the police did have weapons. But if you fire on a policeman or a soldier, his training will be to fire back. That's his training. Okay, so that's what they did. They fired on the security forces, whether they be city policemen or army. They fired on them knowing that they're going to get a reply. And as many dead, innocent civilians protesting in the street, this is furthering their cause.
Right.
This is what they want. So this happened. Then the president came out with an order nationwide saying you can, the security forces can still go and watch the protests, but they cannot carry a weapon.
And that caused...
This caused many, many deaths because they followed the orders, but
and
the
they were
people
knifed.
Were... The protesters slaughtered the policemen.
In reality, the uprising in Daraa in March 2011 was not fueled by graffiti written by teenagers. And there were no disgruntled parents demanding their children be freed. It was part of a Hollywood-style script written by skilled CIA agents who were given a mission to destroy Syria for the purpose of regime change. The violence in Daraa escalated when rooftop snipers killed demonstrators, police, and soldiers. Observers blame the deaths on Assad, but there is evidence the snipers were part of an effort to push the opposition's narrative of a brutal government that must be overthrown. The tactic was also used in Ukraine during the State Department's engineered coup. Similar tactics were used in Romania, Bosnia, Thailand, Egypt, Libya, and as part of the CIA's and NATO's Operation Gladio and its strategy of tension in Europe. According to Saihoni's research, weapons smuggled into Syria came from the CIA stationed in Jordan, where the U.S. has a good relationship with trusted client King Abdullah. After the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, the CIA sent weapons seized in the country to Syria. Details on weapons transfers came out during the Benghazi hearings. The investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reported on the CIA's rat line to get weapons into Syria.
Very early in 2012, I don't know why, but maybe because of the hubris over what the victory we thought we had in Libya, ousting Gaddafi, which is a mess of its own, we set up a very secret operation inside Libya to funnel arms through Turkey into the Syrian opposition, including all sides, those who were secular, those who had legitimate grievances against the Assad government, and the other groups sponsored by the Saudis and the Qataris, who are really trying to create a Wahhabi or Salafist government in Syria, take it over. And this was a very secret operation that went for a long time. It only ended when the consulate in Benghazi was overrun. And it was done without, as I write, without telling Congress.
The CIA also worked with the newly formed Free Syrian Army in Aleppo. The FSA invited foreign jihadists to join the fight against Assad. They streamed in from Turkey, where they had arrived from Afghanistan, Europe, Australia, and North Africa with Turkish and Saudi assistance. Senator John McCain, a staunch neocon, took up the cause of the FSA in Congress and went so far as to enter Syria without a passport.
America's leading advocate of intervention in the Syrian crisis spent about an hour in the country, having crossed over the Turkish border. He met with leaders, senior officials of the Free Syrian Army, and they talked about matters that have been close to John McCain's heart these last few months or so, namely arming of the Syrian rebels, airstrikes and possibility of those, and the creation of a no-fly zone.
By 2012, the CIA was operating out of Turkey, providing weapons and sending fighters over the border into Syria. It provided satellite imagery and other detailed intelligence on Syrian troop locations and movements. The agency also set up an intelligence service for the Free Syrian Army. In the late 1940s, the CIA began covert operations in Syria after Syrians rejected an oil pipeline in their country. The United States also had issues with anti-Western sentiment and a large communist party. CIA operatives met with military leaders in Damascus and plotted to overthrow a three-year-old democratically elected civilian government. It backed the Nationalist Party during the election in 1947. 2 years later, the CIA sponsored a military coup. During a BBC interview in 1967, CIA agent Miles Copeland admitted as much.
The State Department practically asked not to be informed in this case. We did inform the State Department, and you've read the book, you know this case where simply it was hinted to us that we had best shut up about what was happening in the country, and if Hosni Zaim. The case in point. You are talking about
the Syrian case.
Yes.
We overthrew the Syrian
government. If Hosni Zaim
yes.
wanted to have a coup, and if his intention was to get rid of the corrupt government and establish a democratic government, we should leave him alone and stay out of it.
And that was the State Department policy, but in fact, you very largely organized, directed, I mean you personally, but you're among the team who did it, organized and directed this coup.
Exactly.
In 1957, the CIA and MI6 planned another coup in Syria and the assassination of three top Syrian leaders. Documents revealed in 2003 spell out the details of the plan, including an invasion in response to manufactured border incidents and internal disruptions inside the country, including agitating the Shia Druze minority. Frontier incidents and border clashes would be staged to provide a pretext for Iraq and Jordanian military intervention. According to the CIA and MI6, Syria had to be made to appear as the sponsor of plots, sabotage, and violence directed against neighboring governments. In the United States, the effort was led by Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt led the coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953. The plot was abandoned, however, when Jordan, Iraq, and Turkey refused to cooperate. The following year, the Ba'athists took power and embraced the pan-Arab nationalism of General Nasser in Egypt. In 2011, it was revealed that the State Department financed Syrian political opposition groups and related projects, including a satellite TV channel that sent anti-government programming into the country. Barada TV began broadcasting in 2009. It is closely affiliated with the Movement for Justice and Development, a London-based network of Syrian exiles associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The link was mentioned in a diplomatic cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus in July 2009. Reuters reported the Salafist leadership attempting to overthrow Assad is comprised primarily of Muslim Brotherhood operatives. The command structure was established by the U.S., Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. The Syrian National Council, originally the face of the Western-backed opposition, was dominated behind the scenes by the Brotherhood. In 2012, the CIA used the organization to smuggle weapons into Syria over the southern border of Turkey. According to Miles Copeland, the CIA began cooperating with the Muslim Brotherhood in 1955. Saeed Ramadan, the son-in-law of the founder of the Brotherhood, was a longtime CIA and British intelligence asset, according to the Swiss. That same year, British intelligence used the Brotherhood to agitate against the government in Syria after it announced a desire to merge with Egypt.
The flags of Egypt and Syria fly side by side in Cairo as the two Arab nations merge. Presidents Al-Khawatli of Syria and Nasser of Egypt lead in the political joining of the two states that are separated geographically by Israel.
The Muslim Brotherhood became an important asset after Nasser announced the Egyptian takeover of the Suez and talked about a collective Arab security pact within the framework of the Arab League. After the Ba'athist coup in 1963, the Brotherhood recruited Sunni Islamists to confront the government. The Islamists killed Syrian civilians, off-duty security personnel, and security forces. The violence reached a climax in 1982 when Hafez al-Assad besieged the town of Hama for 27 days in order to put down an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood. Between 10 and 40,000 Syrian citizens were killed and the city destroyed. After 30 years of exile, the Muslim Brotherhood was back in business in Syria during the Arab Spring.
إلى سوريا الإخوانية إلى غزة إلى مصر إلى ليبيا إلى تونس إلى المغرب وهنالك صراع على سوريا أيضا من أجل أن تكتمل إمبراطورية الإخوان المسلمين وهنالك أيضا فرع لهم في العراق الآن إخوان المسلمين بدل أن يكون حزب إسلامي أصبح حزب سني.
Representatives of the brothers traveled to Turkey to join other opposition groups based outside the country in setting up the Syrian National Council. Although the Free Syrian Army was portrayed in the West as secular and moderate, it was actually controlled by the Brothers and other radical Wahhabi Salafists. In 2013, the Free Syrian Army said it welcomed al-Qaeda in the fight to depose Assad. The plan and vision for the Arab and Muslim Middle East was spelled out in a U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency document from 2012. The document says Salafist groups, the Muslim Brotherhood, and al-Qaeda in Iraq, now known as the Islamic State, are at the forefront of the effort to depose Assad. The Pentagon document predicts the establishment of a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in Syria.
Our top story, new declassified reports are revealed that Washington had prior information about the presence of Takfiri terrorists in Syria and their plan to establish their so-called Islamic State in the heart of the Middle East. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency's documents, which date back to 2012, and have been published by an American monitoring group have shed light on the rise of the Takfiri terrorists and their activities in Syria. Based on the papers, Washington saw the rise of the ISIL as an effective tool to implement the West's policies in the region and to isolate the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. The documents also predicted that the support given by the West, Turkey, and the Persian Gulf Arab states to the Takfiri militants would eventually lead to the establishment of, quote, a Salafist principality in eastern Syria.
Bashar al-Assad and a secular Syrian government stand in the way of the end game the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Sunni Gulf Emirates have in mind for the Arab world. That end game, spelled out in the 1990s by the neocons, envisions a Middle East balkanized along religious, tribal, and political lines.
So this is information you have not heard before. Let's just go over some of the highlights for a moment. First, it was not Assad's troops or police that were firing upon unarmed civilians. There were agent provocateurs, mainly the Muslim Brotherhood, who had set up a base in the largest mosque in the community, and they were being trained and funded by the CIA. They needed regime change, but they had to make it look like they did in the past, where they said Gaddafi was killing his citizens in Benghazi. All that was lies perpetrated by the CIA. The different groups were then putting snipers up on the roofs, shooting both the security forces of Assad, who were unarmed, and then also in the crowd. So that's what the media picked up on, and that was the excuse that was given. Oh, look, Assad needs to go. We need regime change. And there's the buffoon, and he really is. He represents everything that a perfect politician should be, but has no qualities as a human being, and that's John McCain. He's out there with actual terrorists promoting him. And we gave one terrorist group $500 million, and that came out. And they had to admit that, well, how many people were actually trained? Five or six people. That's $100 million per person. The amount of money, the cash, the corruption, but it was all going to terrorist groups. And that's what you weren't told. And then they wanted the no-fly zone because then Assad could not defend his own people. But also, have you noticed that there's a complete absence of the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN being in Aleppo now, seeing hundreds of thousands of people celebrating in the streets, listening to the true stories? Now they have the actual true stories of what it was like to live under the domain of the so-called, let's say, moderate rebels. No, these were beheaders. These were mass killers. And they're uncovering more and more mass graves of men, women, and children who've been sexually abused. They won't touch this story because now the truth can be told. Because now they don't have the white helmets to be propagandists for the terrorists in the United States. And talking about the white helmets, we give one piece yesterday. Here's part two today.
8 o'clock Thursday morning here in Moscow. You're watching RT International. From the entire news team here, a very warm welcome to you. After liberating the east of Aleppo, government troops are making advances against terrorists that still control several districts of the Syrian city. In response, the militants have once again been targeting civilian areas of western Aleppo. At least three people have been killed and more than 45 injured, many of them children. And these are images from the hospital where the wounded from the latest rebel shelling are being treated. Meanwhile, the mainstream media continues to blame President Assad and Russia for the civilian suffering. Anissa Nawi has looked into their coverage.
Final messages are flying out of Aleppo, Syria. They're taking social media by storm simultaneously. It almost looks like a coordinated PR campaign.
No place now to go. It's the last place.
This may be my last video.
This might be close to, if not the last, communication.
It's the last time that I talk to you.
It's almost as if they were hoping these final messages would trend and get picked up by mainstream media.
Bombs are everywhere. People are running. They don't know where. Just running.
We are here living a genocide, literally.
People are executed. It's as simple as that.
It's almost like these are just innocent civilians with no message, no strategy, no politics, just people simply fighting for their lives. One day, saying goodbye to the world on social media. The next day, giving interviews to BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera, all in prime time. Well, they're not. These are activists. Some of them just recently joined Twitter and clearly support the revolution. They have thousands of followers. Some call themselves journalists and are verified on Facebook, like Bilal Abdul Karim, an American who has no problem pushing al-Nusra propaganda. You know, the rebels. So what do all of these people have in common? They want you to think there's one side to this story, one truth. That Assad is randomly going from city to city and killing his own people for some crazy reason with the help of Russia, even though the whole world is watching every step. They want you to think that these civilians pouring out of Aleppo are running from genocide committed by the Syrian army, and those who celebrate on the streets are dancing on children's graves, while al-Qaeda-infiltrated rebels are bravely and heroically defending civilians in East Aleppo. The question is, do you buy it? Because millions of people do.
Well, the grim picture of Aleppo's liberation painted in the mainstream media has prompted crowds to protest on the streets of European cities. People have gathered in the German city of Hamburg as well as Paris, calling to stop the claimed slaughter of people in Aleppo. Also, the lights of the Eiffel Tower have been turned off in solidarity with the Aleppo civilians. My colleague Neil Harvey heard some very different opinions on the Syrian conflict and the way it's being portrayed in the media.
But what is happening right now at Aleppo is a moral crime against humanity. I agree with what Secretary of State John Kerry said, that the Russian government should do everything to stop it, to end it, to support a ceasefire, to end the carnage and the killing and the misery and the bombing of innocent civilians.
I would like to 100% correct the lies that are being disseminated by media, think tanks, governments across the West. I've spent basically 3 days in all the various liberated areas of East Aleppo. Many of the testimonies that we receive from the civilians that this gentleman has just accused Russia and Syria of bombing actually told us that they had been incarcerated for the last 4 years by the United States-backed various terrorist militant groups.
The spokesperson for the US State Department has given lots of opinions on this, and he said he hasn't seen the videos of people celebrating on the city streets, which we have been showing here on RT. Let's have a listen.
I mean, I haven't seen every picture coming out of Aleppo, but I haven't seen, honestly, Said, I haven't seen any dancing in the streets.
How does Admiral Kirby know what is going on? He says that he just follows information from CNN.
He's a good man. But the point is, we can witness hour by hour, day after day, dead babies by dead babies. The killing, the carnage, the bombing of civilians must stop. The dead children, the dead babies is a moral outrage against humanity.
Now, this is a good example of what's wrong with the mainstream media. You have a mainstream media source and telling us, you've got to believe the government, you've got to believe the U.S. government. This is their same mainstream media that lied through its teeth about Iraq, that lied through its teeth about Benghazi, about the slaughters going on there that were not going on, who are lying through their teeth right now. There are no foreign media sources in East Aleppo right now. They are not on the ground. They are all using information that they are getting through rebel sources.
Evidence of chemical weapons left behind, ISIS flags, weapons of torture, reports of civilians used as human shields. Now, whatever their cause was originally, the way it's ended up, if you look at the evidence, as you like to look at with your eyes and believe, it suggests that, that these people are more akin to terrorists than anything else. Is that not good enough reason to stop supporting them?
There are 500,000 potential Syrian witnesses who are dead. And far too many of those potential Syrian witnesses who are dead were killed by the indiscriminate mass bombing and deliberate mass bombing of civilians.
Brent, you can't be hypothetical when you're talking about a war and civilian casualties. You just cannot be hypothetical. You have to stick to the facts, and the facts are there. The facts are presented by our correspondent who is on the ground.
They have a curious array of endorsers, from the British Foreign Secretary.
They are fantastically brave, these white helmets.
To the poster boy of the formerly named extremist group Jabhat al-Nusra.
I don't call them civil defensemen, but rather the mujahideen of the civil defense.
It appears that the al-Qaeda affiliates' love for the white helmets isn't one way. They celebrate victories together. Still, in an interview with RT, one of its chiefs claims that they have saved tens of thousands of lives.
Not the problem about resource, about the result. We are until now, from 2013 until now, we were able to rescue 70,000 people.
Back in the Jibreen camp, brimming with people that have just fled White Helmet's turf, the organization has quite a reputation amongst the civilians that they're supposed to be saving. Everyone that we spoke to was angry and eager to talk.
Do you ever see in Fardus men with white helmets? They're called the white helmets or the civil defense, helping people when they were injured.
When they came to help the injured, they stole from them. If people were wearing jewelry, they cut it off. All of them are thieves.
Some of them are honest, but many are just thieves. They see gold and they take it.
The white helmets as sheep in wolves' clothing, thieves in disguise, was a common theme amongst the complaints. But the allegations got more serious. This man accused the organization of intentionally killing his little girl.
I took her to the civil defense hospital and they gave her an injection filled with air to kill her.
This man went as far as to celebrate an airstrike on his own house because he said it had been seized by White Helmets workers side by side with rebel fighters.
They forced me to leave my house and told me they were turning it into a Free Syrian Army base. But later they were hit by an airstrike.
Finally, we got to those glossy videos appearing to show their heroics, constantly repeated by the mainstream media.
They don't help people. They only work when there is a camera on them, and when the camera is gone, they leave. They abandon people under the rubble. They told us to pull the bodies out by ourselves.
Lizzie Phelan, reporting for RT from Aleppo.
So, send this clip, please, to Democracy Now! And ask them, would they reevaluate the love fest they had with the documentarian praising the White Helmets and all the other media doing the same? The White Helmets are terrorists. They are right there killing innocent people. And yet, what a propaganda operation. They were given $100 million by the United States, we the taxpayer. And unfortunately, this information is not getting into any of the media, including alternative media. But now you have it. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Dip, 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 dip